I'm so glad that you're all here. Everyone on Zoom. Well, some of you may already know, but my root teacher, Sojin Diane Martin, has been my teacher for 25 years. And during these last 5 months or so, she's been very ill. And so there was a period of about 4 months when we didn't, you know, it was no way that I could really connect with her other than to write her letters or send her cards or, you know, chant, pray, that kind of thing. I would go online to the Sangha that's in the area, and all my Dharma brothers and sisters there were providing care for her. She had to be basically living with other people. She couldn't walk or breathe a lot of the time. At the same time, her husband, who has heart disease, fell and broke his hip. So he was in a rehab center like several blocks away because he couldn't walk. So all this was going on all this time. And somewhere in the midst of this, it just came up for me that I really would like to share her with you, to somehow honor who she is as a teacher and our relationship. So I did go visit her about, I don't know when it was, been maybe 3 weeks ago now, and I'll tell you more about it, but it was an incredible experience to be able to go, and she is doing better at the moment, so it was really a privilege to be able to spend about 4 days with her. So just to tell you, Diane Martin is the founding teacher of Udumbara Zen Center. It was founded in 1997. She's the director of the Buddhist Educational Institute, which is now kind of held in this Indian Creek Zen Hermitage where she and her husband have been living. And but originally, Udumbara Zen Center was in Evanston, Illinois for many, 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 many years and still is still there. So. Anyway, she's a student of Suzuki Roshi, Rebbe Anderson, and Diane Katagiri from Minnesota Zen Center. So her lineages are both Suzuki and Katagiri, and those are my two lineages, too. And she's also a Jungian analyst, and that was her practice life until she became a priest. So I'll be telling you a lot more. But I want to say that when we take refuge in the Buddha, like when we have the full moon ceremony, we chant, immersing body and mind deeply in the way, awakening true mind, awakening true mind. And I've begun to think of that, awakening true mind. If we awaken true mind into our everyday lives, we're actually birthing intimacy, that the intimacy that arises in our relating to the world is the true mind awakening. And we could even ask the question, well, what does that mean, intimacy? And Dogen uses this word a lot, Reb Anderson uses this word a lot, my teacher uses this word, and maybe we could sort of live with the question and wonder about our experiences, because we don't really want to define it exactly. But I can say some things that I know that often I might feel connected to another person because I identify with them. It's like, oh, your experience, that's my experience. And we think that that's a kind of closeness. But when we come to intimacy, in a way, identification sort of shuts down whatever fresh possibility could actually happen between two people who are coming together in a particular moment who've come together from a place of not knowing and wondering what's going to happen between us, and can consider that whatever might happen wouldn't be at all connected to the identifications. So that helps me, and then we can just begin to wonder when we feel that kind of intimacy, and maybe when we don't, and what's going on that's kind of in the way. But another way of wondering about this is that maybe awakening true mind in this crucible of intimacy is when the energy between two is now held by the energy of the true mind. So there's something underneath that's actually at work. I don't know. And maybe you'll have thoughts too. But I like to think of awakening true mind, the birth of intimacy, the relational crucible for actualizing our full aliveness. Because really, life is a relationship. My mentor, philosopher Eugene Genlin, he would always say, never were we ever an individual entity. Human beings were never. Every cell has interrelations in it, opens into other cells. Our lungs are actually made to bring in the air. So already that interconnection is built in to life. Some of these stories maybe you've heard before, but the first time I met Diane was after I had studied with Jon Kabat-Zinn and learned MBSR. And I was very taken by realizing that Buddhism has something to teach us about the nature of the mind. So synchronistically, after that training, it turned out there was a Zen center like four blocks from my house in Evanston. I didn't know. So I went to see her, and she basically said, concentrate on your breath, but not your in-breath. Concentrate on your out-breath. And so, and these things happen to me, maybe they do too. It's not like I was sitting on a cushion concentrating on my in and out-breath. I was driving my car doing that. But that out-breath, suddenly I was filled with all of these different feelings and memories about my brother. Just came in, and pain. I mean, we didn't have a good relationship. But it just all rushed in, and then in the next out-breath, they just flew away. They were gone. There's a lot more that happened about my brother, but I mean, that was like this moment of, wow, what is this? But for some reason, I didn't go back to see her for many months. And then when I finally went back, I felt shame, I felt guilt, I was like nervous. And the Zendo in Evanston had this big wooden door that opened into a garden. And so, but you don't know it's a Zendo, it's just all very private. So I knock on the door, and she opens the door, and she says, I've been waiting for you. And it was like, what? And then she said, go home and sit in the wellspring of life. So I left and I thought, what's that? I mean, what was that that happened? You know, what's the wellspring of life? But I felt something. I felt touched, like the beginning of this entwining of our lives. This story, because Diane and her husband now live at Indian Creek Hermitage in Ottawa, Illinois, that used to be my husband and our farm. We had a farm for 23 years, we had a 23-acre farm for 11 and a half years, and Well, there's all these stories about that, but we began starting to think about selling this farm. And it's deep in a valley. There's bluffs all around. There's acres of farmland to grow alfalfa. There's a creek. It was the most healthy body of water in the area, running into the Fox River that ran through the property. I loved this farm. But then I was already practicing in Evanston, and we were in the vestibule, and I was talking about this farm and that it had real spiritual energy. And Roshi Diane, I call her Diane, she heard me say this, and she somehow believed me. There's spiritual energy here. And then it turned out that her husband had just had a stroke, and he told her he had to be in nature in order to heal. So here it was, the farm was there, and we were, about to leave. We moved to California. So, so that's another kind of entwining, I guess. But anyway, before we moved, we sold the farm. They moved in. They were living there. Oh, the one thing that happened when we were about to buy our farm, there's a house, there's a barn. At the top of the barn, there was like this art studio. And I walked up there, and I opened the door, and I said, this is a Zendo. But it never was a Zendo when we owned the farm. But now it's a Zendo. So anyway, one thing I want to tell you about her is that the way that she would connect with me in Dokusan, one way, there's many ways, but this way, she was very pithy. She would listen to my experience, and what she would say, I felt what she was doing was revealing the Dharma that was at work in what I was sharing. And that's it. Nothing else. So, for example, I went back to the farm after we had sold it for a sesshin, and it was the first time there was a sesshin offered at the farm. And I have to say that what happened there is because we were in sesshin. We sat silently, we did kinhin, we ate in silence, we sat in the zendo, we were on cushions. But we were also walking outside and everywhere else, but I mean, we were practicing. But what ended up happening for me is that because I loved the farm and I hadn't been back, every single thing I saw had changed. They had changed everything that mattered to me. And so I was like, it was this incredible thing. For 2 days of silence, I would just be having to see, oh my God, he painted that bathtub red. He was an artist. I mean, it wasn't funny though, because it was like, this is my precious bathtub. I mean, there were many things. He built this big metal warehouse out in the field. I mean, it was just, but it was like, I had to see, I had to see, I had to see, I had to see, I had to see impermanence, 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 impermanence for 2 days. But then the last day, I was sitting in the zendo. And meanwhile, the whole time we were sitting, he was out there hammering. I don't know what he was making, but noise. Where's the silence? The last day, I sat on the zendo. And I heard the hammering, and it was like, life, 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 life. And all of a sudden, I was just the sound of life. It was incredible. So then, at the end of the day, I did talk to Diane, and I shared her this experience, and all she said was, you've discovered the heart of Zen. That was it. And then this is another example of her doing this. Another time I was in a training group with her and we had been sitting Zazen, and this tremendous anger rose up towards my husband, who's sitting back there. and I was so upset. And in the group, I said, "What am I supposed to do?" And all she said was, "Nothing." That was it. But that was it, right? That's just the example of this like way that she would meet me right at the moment of my practice and give me a teaching without teaching. So another gift and a way that Diane works is that she believes that the koans and the sutras are alive and they're rising up in the moment to meet each of us encountering the koan with what needs to open in our lives. So, and she was so, you know, she would say, "You have to stop your normal mind. You have to stop it." Because, I mean, and it means paying attention, because you can be reading a koan and then all of a sudden you realize, "Oh, I'm skipping over those words. You know, I don't really want to read that part." But if you're not paying attention, that's just what your mind will do. And then you think you've read it. And I've learned that we have many minds. One mind can read something, and another mind can be also reading it. And we don't know. So to stop that kind of, it was also stop the linear, then this, then this, then this, then this. And she would say, "Okay, read the koan backwards." Anything to break up this kind of mental process. I'm just seeing her now because she'd be very animated when she would describe these things. So suddenly, you know, like, this is incredible, isn't it? That koans are like this. So then she would invite me, others, to notice something that jumps out, like a phrase or a word or an image. And she said, "Those phrases and words or images are like a magnet. They're pulling it out of you. The magnet of those phrases are pulling out your karma or your hindrances." And that's the power of stopping with that. And she, well, this is the next point that, she would say, it's the magnets pulling it out. And if you feel something coming, she said, pull over to the side of the road and just sit with it. Because it's only the sitting with will the multiple layers of meaning begin to rise up. So she'll say things like, hold the dragon's mouth open as long as you can. You know, to let this other level come through. She says over and over again, everything in our experience has multiple layers. There's a multiplicity to everything. And the ego doesn't want to get this. The ego wants something to be just this. I know it's this. Or this is fixed. Or what's the real answer? Why I blah, blah, blah. And I hear so many people say, well, why did that happen? And then somebody say, well, I think it's because of this. Or it's because of that. And then she said, well, that's monkey mind. You know, you're just moving around. You're not going down. She said, the ego is afraid of the dark. But the koans are inviting us to go down. And you know, it's taken me a long time, but I think it was the way that she would talk about this that had an aliveness. You know, she was meeting me in the encounter. I mean, I can say it's true. These things happen if you go down. You know, much comes up. And she says, you know, the Dharma is interpenetrating, changing, pulsating. It is exhilarating what's actually going on underneath. And as you can already tell, she had the gift of images and metaphors and dream work. And this is another thing, like to imagine holding the dragon jaw open for as long as possible. You know, that kind of an image, you know, goes in. It brings up something in your whole body, you know, because it's so powerful. So the images themselves carry the multiplicity. And some people talk about the imagery as a link to emptiness. Kind of, it brings you there to the empty space. And going in the dark is, she also uses feminine images a lot, like, you know, you're in the darkness of the womb, or soften your defenses, like the aperture needs to soften and open for the birth canal to come through. She also drew on images from, and this is, I don't know if she found this or I found this, but in the Dharma Hall discourse, there are short dharmas, short teachings from Dogen, number 327, the ancient crane flying throughout the world. And it goes, although it was correctly transmitted, the true Dharma, by arhats, the true Dharma eye treasury did not descend into the Dharma of the arhats. Similarly, for common people, the Dharma was transmitted to them, but it didn't descend into them. And Dogen says, if this were not true, how could this have ever reached us? The Dharma just stayed in the arhats, or the common people. After a pause, Dogen said, after midnight, the moon sets, and the nest is chilled with night. The thousand-year-old crane does not remain in the jewel forest. The thousand-year-old crane does not remain in the jewel forest. It's just the feel, you know, the Dharma, you know, let's go. It goes out, comes forth. And we don't stay in the jewel forest, we go out. Another message that just went deep in for me is that the movement of the Dharma is always entering, always inviting, always just right there. But mostly we don't know that. Mostly it's happening underneath our awareness. This is why attention, and this was something Richard Baker said the other day, attention is more important because awareness isn't ours. Awareness itself is a larger force that's at work, but we pay attention. And so often, Zenju says this too, be aware of the pearls that are racing through. You know, we're not alert, we don't even see what's happening underneath, but it is. So in that sense, if that's true, then we want to allow our process to move of its own accord. We don't want to try to make something happen. it's already happening. The wheel is turning. This is a phrase like a swoosh, the feeling of prajna coming in, unpredicted, unanticipated, uncalled for. You know, it's always beyond what we can know or say. There's another Dogen Dharmet in his Ehe Koroku, practicing with no mind. And I love this. It says, with a monk's bowl with a handle and a monk's robe with horns, a monk's staff blooms and bears fruit, a sitting cushion spreads out roots that grow sprouts. I'll say that again. With a monk's bowl with a handle, like monk's bowls don't have handles, right? And a monk's robe with horns, a monk's staff blooms and bears fruit, a sitting cushion spreads out roots that grow sprouts. So Dogen says, a monk's bowl with a handle and a monk's robe with horns are impossible items. But from such inconceivability, practice bears fruit, as symbolized by the staff blossoming or a sitting cushion sending out shoots. I mean, it's such a beautiful truth. You know, it's a gift to us that no matter how, you know, dim-witted we are, you know, it's still being given to us, you know. So this was the message I just kept getting over and over again by the way she talked to me. And in this context, this is also true for tension and conflict that arose between us. And I have to say, for many years, you know, I would hear, cut through the delusion, or swing the sword of enlightenment, and I was saying, wow, I don't like that. That's so violent and, you know, masculine, aggressive. And I just thought there must be another way. We can be gentle and kind. Okay, so that's true. But in the fourth rank of the five ranks, it says, when two blades cross, no need to withdraw. A master of sword is a lotus burning in fire. In such a person, the spirit soars. So much later in our relationship, we hit some really hard place where Diane became the sword cutter. It's the only way I can describe it, because she was sure that I wasn't seeing something about myself. And we would get into these horrible times because I didn't agree with her. You know, I thought, yes, I see it. And, you know, I would come up with my stories, and then she just kept saying no. And it was scary because I didn't know, you know, are we going to get through this? Or, you know, I thought, well, is she a bad teacher? Or, you know, I went through a lot of stuff. And I can't really tell you how this all happened. But what I do know is that in the midst of all of this, I was here sitting Zazen, and my core childhood issue is, you know, sort of deep loneliness. Like, I grew up feeling like wondering if I existed, kind of feeling. And if that comes up in me, my usual way of dealing with it is to, oh, well, why don't you call so-and-so? Or why don't you make a date and have lunch with this person? Or, you know, fix it. But somehow that night, I just sat there and I somehow found some deep compassion for myself. And it was, you know, very deep and very powerful. And then, we ended the sit and we had the service, and I stood up, and before I knew it, my body just walked over to this woman who had never been here before. And I just walked over and to say hello and introduce myself. And she said, "I'm so glad you came over because I've been feeling so lonely." And it suddenly made me realize, oh, it was my self-compassion towards my loneliness that awakened the channel of compassion towards somebody else who's lonely, without my knowing even that that's what was happening. So somehow, in the midst of all of this, back to Diane, back to almost this horrible wall, and I don't know what happened in me. Suddenly, I just turned to her and I said, "I really want to understand what you see in me." And all my defensiveness, all my, no, and blame, it was all gone. And so she shared, and I could see that she had been in pain all this time because she felt the wall between us and didn't want the wall. And so in my able to hear her, the wall went up, and she was so happy. It was incredible, and I can't even remember what the particulars were exactly. But that was that sense of intimacy again, because, she had been in pain. I didn't know. This is what Dogen writes about too, and this is what intimacy is, that the Dharma comes alive in the particular. I mean, I think Dogen says this, you have to weigh everything in its particularity. So no abstraction, because that flattens out differences, global statements, conceptualizing, is abandoned to tolerate things. So the particularity, and I think I've shared this with you before, but when I was sewing my rakusu for my Jukai, at a certain point I thought, what the heck am I doing this for? I'm sewing. And I went to my teacher, and the teacher said, it's to learn particular awareness, to learn to see. And I walked out, she said this, I walked out, and I was on this busy street in Sacramento, and all of a sudden I saw a person right in front of me asking for money. And I knew that before she had said that, I wouldn't have seen that person. I really don't think I would have. Particular awareness, also connects us on some deep level. But at the same time, we each are particulars. Our lives are each our own unique life, and we are a particular. And so I felt like Diane really always honored my particularity, I guess. Like Hakuin in his Four Ways of Knowing talks about the Dharmakaya and the difference between discriminating mind, where you compare and contrast and this, to differentiating mind, which is when you discern, the particularity of someone's true self. So she would listen to when, and this was sort of my practice, to listen for what came, not knowing, oh, do this. And those things kind of would unfold, like you know, creating the pilgrimage to the South, or these things would come up, and she would just be right there. Never questioning that in a way, once she understood what that meant for me. So I have deep gratitude for that too. So when I went to see her, I mean, it's like a pilgrimage, because we flew to Chicago and we had to rent a car, which was so complicated, and then drive 2 hours to get to Ottawa. And, you know, it's a big deal now to go to the farm. But she had just moved back to the farm. She had gotten enough energy, and everybody told her she should never go back. But of course you go back to your farm. I mean, and her, you know, they have a full-time caregiver. Her husband can't walk. They have ramps everywhere. It's a very fragile place. But she was at the farm, and I thought I was going there to help her. You know, I thought, well, I didn't know what, but cook or clean or something. But instead, she was just like, we just sat together. And she was so happy to see me. I felt her joy. And I felt my joy. And then she had a dinner for us, but catered for other Sangha members. And we all, it was like, it was such a joyous evening. And I just feel like, okay, joy just spread through the room. It wasn't anybody's in particular, but the joy of being together. I don't know, yesterday or so, I was walking and feeling the joy like this, remembering, and then I don't know. I could feel like I was grabbing onto the joy. And when I let it go, all of a sudden I'm thinking about the children in Gaza. I'm telling myself, don't forget your white privilege. What about my friend who was an immigrant? So this is the Dharma wheel turning. It's like letting go, and then there's the ongoing openness. You know, Diane and her husband are fragile, and yet we're joyous, and yet they're suffering, and we're all together. And maybe that's intimacy. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. Thank you, everybody. I mean, we can talk.
Thank you for sharing so much of yourself. You weren't just sharing stories, you were really sharing of yourself. And you're our Eno, and knowing is most intimate, but knowing and hearing can be intimate too. what you said at the beginning, talking about the awakening true mind, yeah. That's always something that grabs me.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, and
yeah.
So, and you're talking just towards the end a bit, discriminating mind
versus differentiating mind.
So one is like looking at how things are different from us, and the other is maybe seeing how something is simply unique in itself. Would that be kind of...
Well, I mean, when you talk about discriminating mind, when you try to say what something is, you say it by comparing it to other things. What happened? You both like that.
Well, I don't know, but well, we all...
Oh, that was from the computer. I'm sorry.
Yeah, whatever. Made Lisa's bitch fall.
And so you're sort of trapped in a kind of conceptualizing, and you know, like, in a sense, reducing something to something. But differentiating mind is you know, the deeper clarity that comes from seeing something for what it is. And then so that would be a kind of a discernment. Like if you're sensing an action, then you're going to be discerning, you know, is this, you know, following the precepts or something like that. Then your input or what it is that you're considering would be different. I probably didn't say that very well.
Thank you.
We have a question on Zoom from Barbara as well.
Okay.
Yep. I'll make mine really quick.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, name's Tim. Nice to meet you. Thank you for that talk. That was really insightful. It's great. Just quick thing. You were talking a lot about intimacy. I was thinking about, were you talking about like having rocky moments with like people that are close to you, like with your teacher?
Yeah.
How do you learn like to be open to that intimacy and that connection even after having moments of pain? Like how do you learn to like still be open even when sometimes that openness isn't rewarded?
Well, I guess the first thing is maybe there's not one answer to that question.
Right.
But the start would be to really honor your pain and to create a kind of a safe space within yourself or with somebody else where you can learn more about your own pain and be compassionate towards it. I think that would be the first step, because it would be only out of that deep self-love, really, that you could then ask that question to discern, because you would want to be discerning about how to engage in a way that, you know, could have some healing in it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for the question. But Barbara, did you say you had something to say?
Yes. Thank you so much for this talk. I know you a long time. This is the most intimate sharing. And I want to thank you for your courage. The greatest dana we have to give, perhaps, is courage. Courage, giving others the courage to also face their most intimate quests and questions. So I thank you for your courage and for extending that courage to us, the invitation for us to be courageous. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing about Diane. So many things I didn't know about her, and
yeah,
I'm gaining more insights into her. So thank you, Mike.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. And I mean, I think I realized it felt like we don't usually talk about our teachers, sort of. I mean, there is an intimacy in that relationship too that is very precious. And you know, I've had some experiences like trying to talk to somebody about my teacher who isn't necessarily Buddhist or understands a lot of these things, and I feel like I violated something almost in myself, you know, because this all happens on another level, really, that what is transpires between us, and it's just hard to communicate. But maybe in this context, yeah, we can.
Yeah, and I think finding a teacher is such an incredible revelation. And those of you who are curious about the relationship with a teacher, I think we've heard a great opening to that this evening. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Patrick.
Thank you, Doralee. That was really beautiful.
Thank you.
It has me thinking, I think it was, must have been Thich Nhat Hanh that I was reading a few days ago, talking about, you know, the relationship between teacher and student, and how, I really have to paraphrase because I don't remember, but it had to do with, you know, keeping the teacher alive through the student's practice and sharing, you know, the teacher that way, which I think you very obviously demonstrated. And and also just thank you for doing that through not just telling us about intimacy, but really showing us intimacy. So it was really something special. So thank you.
Thank you.
I also want to say thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. I just want to share that one thing I really appreciate about your sharing is that, let's see if I can say it in a way that makes sense to anyone, is something I need to hear that I hear you say, is that situations and things are rarely clear or rarely one-sided or rarely one way. And as a person who's newer on the path to Buddhism, it's good to hear you talk about how things are rarely perfect. And you're often bring up in your stories, you know, it's going along this way, but then there's also this. And there's joy, but then there's also suffering. So it's encouraging to me to hear that from you and to be reminded, like you were talking about, just to live with eyes open and being open and letting it be instead of my tendency to think, well, I need to figure it out and be just one way. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you, Doralee. That was a very, very beautiful and very moving talk. And I really liked what you were saying also towards the beginning, somewhere or other, about slowing down. I think that's so important,
right?
You know, because the tendency is to rush. And culturally in America, you know, we tend to rush, and then, you know, we want to get there and wherever that is, right? And whenever I slow down, you know, different things happen.
Right, exactly.
Really different things happen.
Right.
And I really appreciate that.
Yeah, right.
I think it's a really good reminder because we're in such a sped up environment.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've also noticed sometimes if I'm sitting and I don't even know, something's going on, and suddenly I think, oh, you know, I'm ready to stop, and my body wants to get up, you know, oh, I have so much to do, and it's like, wait, don't get up, you know, stay, stay with whatever that is, because that's when the next layer is going to come. But if you get up, then it's gone. But that's a discipline, really. So
it's a discipline, and it's also intuition, right? It's like,
mm-hmm.
cause
well,
like
that's
when,
true.
When
right.
you're writing poetry or mm-hmm. something, mm-hmm. like you, something happens, and there's like, oh, there's a phrase. And if you don't grab it right then, it's going to be gone.
That's true.
It's gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's the same kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it is amazing to really like stay paying attention to each thing that comes, because it's kind of amazing where it's taking you. You know, it doesn't stop. That's the turning of the wheel. But we tend to stop it. You know, we get scared, or, you know, our patterns come in, and whatever comes up, it's uncomfortable or something. But, you know, the more we can be in the uncomfortable, then, you know, so much happens, I guess. It just keeps going. It moves. It's very dynamic. Yeah. Sean.
Thank you, Dorley. I know that was difficult for you to share this because of trying to monitor your own emotions, mm-hmm. and congratulate you on doing that, because you did that very well, because mm-hmm. it's kind of hard to talk about something when your own heart is just so filled with mm-hmm. So many things, and, mm-hmm. and you have to get through it and then present and speak to a room of people. It's a vulnerability mm-hmm. that I just thank you for sharing with us.
Mm-hmm.
There are two things that I loved. The idea of the living word, the living mm-hmm. word of a sutra, of mm-hmm. a psalm, of a prayer, of a koan.
Mm-hmm.
These are, from my tradition, what we call a verbum, a word. Mm-hmm. And they're a word that's given to us, and it's a living thing, and it's what we need to hear, mm-hmm. and we have to pay attention to it, and mm-hmm. it becomes a part of us.
Mm-hmm.
But I also loved, you and I've talked about this because you know I have this background in swinging swords.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the very thing about Zen is that we the things that we find mm-hmm. that repulse us, like the banging hammer mm-hmm. during the sesshin, or the mm-hmm. red bathtub, or all those things that were just assaulting you,
mm-hmm.
and the imagery of a sword and cutting delusion mm-hmm. as being violent and masculine. But then we suddenly realize the paradox. That's the very thing that I need to.
Exactly.
I have to pay attention to.
Exactly.
That's what such a great gift, because I can't mm-hmm. sit there and say, well, that's distasteful. I mm-hmm. don't like that.
Yeah,
I don't like that delivery method. You know?
Right. And, because that blocks the intimacy, too,
yeah.
because it just keeps the wall up.
Mm-hmm. And the mystery, yeah. too, the other thing that I just think was so beautiful, and you touched on this so well, mm-hmm. is the mystery and the paradox of the one in the particular and the many and the one,
mm-hmm.
the big one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the whole idea of awareness, awareing itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And being our state of at the center of the Dharma wheel, I guess
mm-hmm.
you might say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. I think, is that Oscar? Yeah, hi Oscar. I can't hear you, though. You're muted.
How about now?
There, good.
All right, great. I want to thank everyone who's commented already, because there's not much left for me to say about how intimate and sweet and pure
mm-hmm.
the talk was. Mm-hmm. I'm very touched by it.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in a lot of things that you said, but one thing was Diane's exhortation to you to, I think it was, you've got to stop your mind. So that, I think the context was so that the words of the sutra or the koan can leap free of the page and be there for you instead of...
Yes.
Instead of being walled off by what you know.
Exactly.
You know? Mm-hmm. But I wonder, but I'd like your thoughts about a difficulty that I have sometimes in that endeavor, which is that I'm trying then to achieve something, trying to achieve stopping my mind, and there's a me there that wants to do that in order to be a better Zen student or whatever. And sometimes it's hard for me to break free. Sometimes it's not a problem, but sometimes it's hard for me to break free of that. I wonder if you could relate to that. And if so, what your perception of it is.
Break free of the mind working at something, kind of, or staying engaged in that way. Is that what you mean? I want to make
sure. Undermining itself, really. Self-sabotage.
Right. I mean, I guess I like the distinction between attention and attention. Pay attention. So it's more like a lot of times when my mind's going like that, I'm not paying attention. I don't notice quick enough, or, you know, I've kind of gotten lazy or something, I don't know. And so if that's true, maybe I stop reading for a while and go do something else and come back, not to push it or not to, you know, criticize myself or something, because maybe there's a certain kind of place I need to be in order to be with a koan in that way. I mean, that happens to me a lot. I'll start reading, and then I realize, you know, I'm not really reading. You know, I'm really not. So, and then also, I tend to read things more than once, because that's the other thing. You know, we have different minds that are reading. So I might read something one day, and then the next day I'll read it again, and it'll be a whole different experience. And so that's another way to get out of that kind of habitual pattern, I think.
Right. So what I'm hearing is you're open to receiving that message that you're having a problem.
Right.
And letting it be.
Correct. Yes. Right. Correct. Yeah. That's a kind of my achievement oriented side has to also calm down, so no, I can't read it anymore now. Yeah, thank you. Lisa,
I don't know if we have time. Thank you, it's a really moving talk. I was interested in the teaching that you shared with us when you had all of that anger come up and you were so bothered.
Oh, yeah.
And Diane said, and you said, what should I do? Nothing.
Yeah.
And I mean, I sort of...
I mean, she didn't quite have that tone.
Right.
But
no. When you said it, you had a little bit of
that's
that.
True. I did.
So, I mean, I understand it, I think, on a basic level as, you know, we create all of these stories and we don't have to act on them. But I was wondering if you could comment a little bit more on what you took from that teaching.
Well, it was very powerful, actually, because it was like, this awareness of this is itself a liberating of it. It can't ever be what it was because it came up. I think it has to do with being in samadhi and things coming up. Like the Dalai Lama says, it's only the unconditioned mind that can see the conditioned mind. And so I think it was because we were in samadhi and the anger came up in that way, and then she had that response. It just, again, was this mirror of, you know, it's okay. something's already changed. Don't fix it because it's already gone in the way, in this particular way. Not that I never get angry at it. So, that's actually clarifying for me too. I think this has a lot to do with the meditation practice itself and what the samadhi state offers to us. I've had things come up like, my brother gave me this crazy birdhouse thing, and I never liked it at all. And then I was reading some koan and it said, don't throw away the gift. And then all of a sudden this birdhouse came up. And it was like incredible because it really was this gift, this birdhouse. And, it made me feel connected to my brother in a way that I didn't before. And it's not that I even ever put it up in real life, but it functioned in a different space offer love, offer freedom, offer liberation, yeah. So that's what I would say. Carolyn.
First, I want to say how much I appreciate you sharing your heart and your soul with us and allowing yourself to be truly vulnerable with us. And I was so touched by it. And it led me to think about who is my teacher right now. And amazingly, it's this 7-year-old boy in my neighborhood. I have been so despairing for such a long time. God, I didn't know. About not having much contact with my grandkids. So I decided that I was going to give away popsicles to my neighbors. And I have children knocking on my door every day, all day, coming for a popsicle.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I have this one little boy who is having trouble reading. And I bought him for Christmas a book called Dog Man, which is just the funniest little book. And he has trouble reading. And we sit and read this book together. And I get to cheer him on. And he gets to be, it's hard. He should be reading and he's not. But what I was aware of today was we're just together. And that's the most important part. And he is just a wonderful little boy. If he finds my newspaper on the driveway, he picks it up and brings it to the door. When somebody spilled some water, he was the first one to clean it up. There is this whole wonderful heart and soul that he's sharing with me.
Yes, and that you're opening yes.
And
how
I'm
beautiful.
The one who's learning, which is what was really my big surprise, is the person who's learning and gaining the most from this relationship is me. And I didn't know that until tonight. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your grandmother mind.